She climbs a tree and scrapes her knee. Her dress has got a tear.
She waltzes on her way to mass and whistles on the stair. And
coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Marnie Nixon. We also discuss Peter's play Adam's Gifts, Handel with Care at the West Side Theater, The New York Pops Under the Mistletoe with Ashley Brown. We also talk about John Tartaglia's A Charlie Brown Christmas at Carnegie Hall. Please stay tuned.
I hate to say it, but I very firmly feel
Maria's not an asset to the Abbey.
I'd like to say a word in her behalf.
And say it, Sister Margareta.
Maria makes me laugh.
How do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you catch a cloud and pin it down?
How do you find Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, December 22nd, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Stripper, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, Peter. So I think that if, in fact, you are strapped for that last-minute gift, that someone could go to the Drama Bookstore or to Amazon.com and get Stripper, Showgirls, and Sharks, as well as many other books, couldn't they?
God love you, yes.
I just want to remind everybody that, you know, that's one way to get it. So also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
With us this morning, we have a special guest. Marnie Nixon is joining us. Marnie is a jewel of Broadway and the entertainment industry across the world. And thank you so much for joining us this morning, Marnie.
You're very welcome.
So tell us the pressing question that most people are going to ask right away is, did you see The Sound of Music live? The NBC Sound of Music that was on a few weeks ago.
Yes, I saw it on television. I thought it was live. I was like, could I go someplace to look at that? I wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, they called it that. They called it The Sound of Music Live. I think that was their official name.
Because it was a live telecast from the studio in Long Island.
Yes, yeah. I understand. Sorry, I was being facetious.
So tell us, what was your thoughts there?
Well, I thought that I was just aghast because the way that it was done, you know, and when you knew that it was done like in all in one studio and it was telecast live and it was a live performance, all of the attention to the details of the sets and of the lighting and of course of the staging and everything was so it was magnificent. However, the content of the piece, the intent of what they were saying, it was like they're saying lines they don't even know what the show is about. it's as if the director said, well, it'll play itself, just say the words. Because we've heard those directions from directors before, but you have to know the intent behind the words. You can't just say the words. You have to know what's there, what the story is, what the import, what the inflection, what the meaning is behind the whole thing. And nobody seemed to have thought of that.
All right. So the question becomes, did you watch the entire broadcast?
Well, I must admit, I didn't see the first part, the very first part. I turned on maybe about half an hour into it, and so I didn't see some of the first stages. And I was sorry. Oh my gosh, I missed this. And suddenly I was, appalled immediately. So
did you stay with it till the end, or did you?
Yes, I thought there's got to be some mistake.
You're a good soldier. Right.
We should clarify, just for those who don't know, that aside from Marnie's fame, dubbing the roles, the singing roles of Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady, and Anna in The King and I, and Maria in the film of West Side Story, her most famous screen appearance, I think it's safe to say, is as Sister Sophia in the beautiful film version of The Sound of Music.
Well, I must say, in The Sound of Music, because it's been around so long, it's a real classic. I've played a lot of the roles. I've played the princess, the countess.
The countess, yes. The baroness.
And I've played Sister Sophia. I've played the lead. And then I've played other people. I played the Mother Abbess. Hmm. And it's just, so you know the play pretty well. And anyway, it was just, it would seem to me that that if this has come around so long and there are Sound of Music sing-alongs and things that everybody has, obviously they've watched, that everybody else would know the import of what is there. But it seems like of all the people, the director didn't know what the content was.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of that too, of people saying lines and not really seeming to realize what they were saying. And I also noticed, I was a little surprised that Stephen Moyer, who played the captain, there were sections where he seemed to have the same expression on his face for like a half hour at a time.
To me, it's like you hire perhaps a popular singer who hasn't done a lot of acting, and you tell him a general thing. Well, the captain is angry, or something.
Yeah.
So, and that's the extent of it. Angry at what? And what do you mean angry? Does he speak in short terms? Why does he do that? Is he very curt? No pun intended, because of the character.
Don't think I wasn't thinking of making something of that. Go ahead.
Why is he speaking that way? Where is his background? And what is his intent behind it? I mean, so he has a certain characterization of the syntax of how he speaks, but there was nothing like that. It was like, I just think this like I'm mad at everything. That's a general acting rule that you might give to some, 5-year-old or something.
Now, given the fact that you say you came in late, therefore, did you miss the song Maria?
Yes, I did.
All right. Now, Freud says there are no accidents. Was this purposeful? Because that's the scene that we know you from in the movie. Did you think that subconsciously you avoided seeing that scene because that would be too painful?
Actually, I just forgot that it was going to be on on the screen, and I was busy doing something, and then suddenly I thought, oh my gosh, and then slipped into there was nothing. Subconscious.
For what it's worth, that number happened to feature several really respected stage talents.
Sure.
Audra McDonald, Christiane Noll. I'm not sure if Ashley Brown was in that number, but the several of those nuns were New York theater professionals who, apparently to one degree or another were able to give their own successful performances without any help from the director.
Right. Exactly. Well, I saw later on subsequently I saw Audra McDonald, and actually I did not even know who was in it, and I didn't recognize Audra at all.
I didn't realize
that was Audra, and I thought, well, this is pretty interesting because it seemed real, This was, it looked like she was really herself, whoever that was, being the nun in that era and speaking from her own, you know, just regular syntax of the way she would speak naturally. I thought it was quite good. It was wonderful. Then when I just saw a little bit of the nun scene, so I can't say really anything about the other nuns, really. There were just a few little entrances that I saw. So.
Sure. Yeah, I'm doing a book about the 1963-64 season. You mentioned that you played the Mother Abbess. You mentioned that you played the Baroness, etc. I found out that season in 63-64, you actually played Eliza Doolittle at City Center.
Yes, that's right.
That must have been such an enormous media event, because for those who are too young to know this, really, there was rarely a day in 1963 that your name wasn't in the papers because of the Audrey Hepburn dubbing. What was it like to actually play the role in New York? Was there a lot of media attention at the time?
Well, yes, and it was the first time that I had really done a big musical like this on stage. And it was in New York, and I was still, I was coming from Los Angeles at that point, and coming here and just, temporarily being in New York. It was absolutely the most wonderful experience.
And I imagine, though, that there were plenty of newspaper articles and reviews about this because of all the controversy of finally we get to see the woman who has provided the voice for this upcoming film. So that must have been really amazing under the circumstances.
Okay, now wait a minute. I was suddenly flipping in on doing My Fair Lady at City Center.
Right.
And I didn't that. I was talking about that in my mind. Suddenly I was talking about Sound of Music.
No, no, we're talking about My Fair Lady.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we are talking about
that. That's exactly what I mean.
All right. Well, see, you got to watch my mind a little here. Okay, good. All right. So fine. That's fine.
But was that, Peter, exactly, I didn't realize this was more or less right before the film was coming out or around?
No, I had just done the dubbing for it.
Right, but it was before the film came out. The film came out.
Yes, but the film had not. I think the film was had just come out. Besides, and I thought then that people would think that I was doing. I mean, this was a line that I always had. It was like an imitation of Julie Andrews doing an imitation of Audrey Hepburn.
Sure. Now, when you were doing these movies, did you rub elbows with the people you were dubbing? Did you ever meet them? Did you ever see them? Was it something that they purposely kept you away from them?
Oh, well, when I was doing the movies, it was a primary necessity to work with the actresses as much as possible, and especially in The King and I, when it was because it was sort of early in the age of even having known anything about dubbing or anything. It was spectacular working with the actresses and standing side by side and hearing their rendition of what they were singing. But when I was doing, the first one was The King and I with Deborah Carr. That filming at the studio was spectacular because every day we would come in and I could really watch her learn the score herself at the piano with me being there, then going to the sound stage where they had set up all the furniture just like it would be in the scene as if they were shooting it, and walking and staging it and standing next to her and watching her sing while I was singing at the same time. And we would look at each other and take each other's intent and import and just sort of imitate each other but singing both at the same time while we were walking through the scene. And then we would go to the sound stage where the orchestra was and record the song. And then we would stand side by side. Some of the numbers that were that had her singing and me singing in places, the verses of some of the songs were her totally, and then she would point to me when I was to come in. The soliloquy, for instance, was a combination, and we would point to each other as we had rehearsed it from within a measure. It would be sometimes me and sometimes her, or something. And then she would have to agree to that and to listen back as we had recorded it and to mouth it. And then she had to then mouth to that track when it got to be filmed. And so it was a complicated process, but it was really up to her. Then she had to really have the lip syncing just right down pat, you know?
All right, now this brings up a good point, and the question becomes, did any of these ladies, be it Deborah Carr, Natalie Wood, Audrey Hepburn, resent you? Just resent the fact that they couldn't do it all, that you made them feel inherently inferior, that they couldn't sing? Was there any dynamic like that involved?
Well, they all knew that they couldn't sing well enough to do the picture, except for Natalie Wood, who in West Side Story assumed, I don't know, that she was being put upon, that they would have a dubber do a lot of her singing in the first place. She kind of begrudged the fact that I had some of the high notes that she couldn't really do quite well enough, but she had the illusion that her recording of it was going to be good enough.
I see.
And so they actually, Robert Wise, the director, had to choose to really let her think that her initial recording of the songs, which she had done with me also, she would record a version, then I would record a version, and in the initial recording. Then when the film got to be done, they put on her recording of it. She mouthed to her recording all the way through, thinking it was herself. Then they had me come back to earphones, and then I had to redub in her performance my voice, which was difficult because they, for some strange reason, they forgot that because she wasn't right in sync with some of the film, that I couldn't just fix that up. They said, well, Marnie, you fix that up. And they didn't realize that I couldn't change her lip pattern. Mm. So I had to sing to her lip pattern, even though she wasn't quite with the film.
Mm. And as I noted, the one tremendously obvious example of that is right in the Tonight duet, when it goes into the chorus. Just as you start to sing Tonight, there's a huge close-up, not of Natalie Wood, but of Richard Beamer. And that apparently is because that was a section where her voice, she was really off with the orchestra. And so they couldn't cut
to another mugshot.
Exactly.
Oh, dear.
It's really interesting. Well, before I forget, I should make a note for those in the New York area that on January 26th, The King and I, an archival 35mm print of it, which I've seen and looks absolutely incredible, is going to be screened at Film Forum. And then on much earlier than that, this Thursday on December 26th at the Walter Reed Theater at Lincoln Center, there will be a screening of My Fair Lady as part of their George Cukor Festival.
Mm. Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I've seen it many times, but somehow you kind of live through it again when you watch it. You think of all the physical things you were doing while you were recording it, and I don't know. But also the content of these musicals. There's nothing that compare nowadays.
Oh no, absolutely not
at all. It's wonderful.
Marnie has a wonderful book called I Could Have Sung All Night, written with Stephen Cole. And one of the stories that I'm pretty sure is in that is I love your story about how when you showed up to film The Sound of Music, that there was maybe some thought that perhaps it might be somewhat awkward with Julie Andrews because you had dubbed Audrey Hepburn in the film of My Fair Lady, but you recount how Julie was really wonderful to you and came over and said hello and you know how much she enjoyed you, your singing and all of that. So I thought that was a wonderful story.
Yes, well, she's very gracious and I think she's very thoughtful, and it was at a time when all the actresses were being introduced to the dubbers and the other people that were coming into the movie, and we were in Robert Wise's bungalow and in this very small space and introducing to each other and Julie Andrews, this is Marnie Nixon, and she immediately got up from her chair. She walked across the room, spread out her hand, thrust her hand out to shake it, and she said, Marnie, I'm such a fan of yours. It was just spectacular. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like impromptu also. I don't think she had pre-thought at all, but it was wonderful. Put everybody at ease.
All right. We've talked about The King and I. We've talked about My Fair Lady. We've talked about Sound of Music. Let's talk about a lesser-known title. Not that you were technically involved with it, but nevertheless, I want to know if you have any memories of the musical called I'm Solomon, written by Ernest Gold, who was your husband. So were you around at that time? Did you see much of I'm Solomon at the Mark Kellinger Theater?
Yes, we moved the whole family to New York. I was then living in Los Angeles. And we moved them all here. I mean, the kids, and we had an apartment in I don't know, one of the hotels on the west side here. And so we could be with Ernest as he finished the project. And I got to see the show several times.
What do you remember most?
And, well, Ernest was having a hard time composing it, I think. There were certain problems with some of the singers. I just remember going to some of the shows and the premiere. I don't know, it just didn't seem to work.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem to connect up together, and I can't remember why that was. I don't know that. I mean, I can't say that it was because of his score at all, and I don't think I would, even if I thought that, because it's not fair.
Sure.
But
sure.
I don't, I think it just, the whole thing technically somehow didn't quite make it for for various reasons.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, there was a musical version of Exodus as well, called Ari, and of course, Ernest Gold wrote that wonderful theme for the movie of Exodus that became a real pop standard. Do you know if he was offered the chance to write the musical version of Exodus for the stage, Ari?
No, I don't think so at all.
Okay.
No.
So let's look forward to this upcoming March and April at the Transport Group. You're going to be doing I Remember Mama.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
We're looking forward to seeing you in it, too.
So
thank you.
And I
must say that, you know, it's going to be a special version, I think, so that it's not going to be a huge, big production, you know, lavish production, but very, very intent, and I'm looking forward to the way it's going to be treated.
Transport Group is billing it as 10 women, 23 roles, and one family, an American classic reborn.
Uh-huh.
So,
good actresses. He always chooses wonderful actresses, and some of them I know already and have done, we've done a workshop of this before, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, great. That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. So that's going to be on March 16th through April 20th, coming up in the 2014. That is rapidly approaching.
It sure is.
gee, I got to remember to stay alive until then.
Marnie, thank you so much for joining us on your Sunday morning.
I've enjoyed it so much.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful rest of the day, and we'll speak with you soon, hopefully after the Transport Group production.
Thank you. I'm looking forward.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye, Marnie.
So I think the three of us are going to have to get down to the Transport Group and see that. That looks like it's going to be very good.
Yeah, I from what I understand, it's going to be like at least one of the previous Transport Group productions where it's not necessarily cast in terms of age appropriate. I know they didn't they do a famous Our Town that had, you know, older people in the, you know, as the young lovers, and in this case people are going to be cast, you know, all across the spectrum. And also interesting that there are going to be no men in it, because aside from everything else, I remember Mama is famous among some of us as I don't know if it was the Broadway debut, but it was one of the earliest examples of Marlon Brando on stage. So
absolutely,
that was definitely some testosterone going on there.
Well, you know, it's so interesting that this is a show that has so many people in it and has such a history with Rodgers and Hammerstein, because they actually produced it. They didn't produce many shows, certainly not many that weren't their own, but this was one that they did. And of course, many years later, Richard Rodgers, without Oscar Hammerstein, who had long been gone at that point, did the musical version of I Remember Mama, which wasn't successful, I'm sorry to say. But nevertheless, and it's funny because Maureen Silliman, who was in my play Adam Skips this past weekend, was in that production. And, we were talking about it a bit last night after the show. And what I didn't realize is that she joined the show in Philadelphia. And so I said, oh, then you replace somebody. Well, she said, I didn't, because they used to have two narrators, one old woman and one young woman. In fact, it was Kristen Vigard, the original Annie, and Martin Charnin had fired her from Annie, and here he was working on I Remember Mama, and he cast her, and we all thought, oh, isn't it wonderful? He's trying to make it up to her. But then they decided, you know, he just couldn't fire her again. I mean, he put her in the chorus, you know, I mean, at least that. But Maureen Silliman came in to do the part. But I remember I Remember Mama is such a lovely play, very, very touching. And the movie version is very good, too. So in case you haven't run into this property, it is one worth seeing. It certainly takes you back to a quieter, lovelier time when family was so much more important than it seems to be today. You know, of course, there are a lot of circumstances why families aren't together today. But this was a time when this was your whole world. And but I have no idea how they're going to accomplish this with 10 ladies and nobody else. But because really, Uncle Chris is a blustery guy. And as you say, the kid and the father, who is so significant in the play and was less significant in the musical, I have to say, George Hearn, who played the role, disappeared at the end of the first act. It was like he went back to Norway to make some money, you know, working. So you didn't see him, and it was so bizarre. So, but anyway, yes, it will be. If this is the way we can get a production of I Remember Mama, you know, with so many characters in it, I guess we'll have to take it.
As Peter says, the musical was not a success. I saw it, and I very much remember Maureen singing that opening song.
That's right, yeah.
I Remember Mama most of all.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. But had it been successful, the role was created in the musical by Liev Ullmann, and then there was a recording made some years later with Sally Ann Howes. But actually, Marnie would have been a wonderful...
And
the other interesting small world thing is that although I never saw it, I'm aware that there was a TV series of I Remember Mama, which starred as Mama Peggy Wood, who played the Mother Abbess in the film of The Sound of Music.
Right. So it's all coming back. Yeah, that Mama's TV series was popular in its day. So again, you know, I mean, of course, this was the era of TV when there were so many family-oriented shows. Mama, I think it was called, predated even Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver. But it may very well have set the tone for shows about loving families and the struggles of everyday life and yet surmounting them.
So Peter, you talked, you briefly touched upon the your work this week on Adam's Gifts, and I wanted to kind of interview you about that. How was that whole process for you, and what was it like? I saw some very heartwarming posts on Facebook about it. So tell me about your experience in writing a play and putting it up on its feet and seeing it come to fruition this week.
Well, I have to say that our director, Daniel Nyden, really found so much in it that never even occurred to me. He solved so many problems. I mean, I had one scene where somebody came in and went out, came back again, and he found a way of keeping the person on stage. I mean, that's just a little thing. But it was really great to be on the other side and see how much work goes into something. We really don't get to realize how much work those of us who really don't do this for a living, little details over and over and over again, and let's go back, you know, and all that. I mean, I know this is not news to anybody who's worked with anything, but it was really something to sit there day after day after day after day and see it slowly but surely come together. So as I wrote on Facebook, my favorite experience was at the end of the show when people came up to me and hugged me, and I could feel that their cheeks were damp, that they did some crying. And I mean that. I will take a polygraph test. You know, I mean, that sounds like an easy thing to say. But they laughed and they cried. And you can't ask for any more than that. So I'm hoping somebody will take an interest in this show and keep it going, because a lot of people think, including me, of course, that it should have more of a life. So we'll see what happens. But I mean, it was very nice of St. John's Church to do this. They do something every Christmas, and this was what they chose to do this year. So that's why it was one weekend only. It's what they had the budget for. But I was very, very fortunate that they liked the play so much, and thank the Lord that the pastor thought it was a terrific show. You know, you can always tell at the end of a show who really likes it, because they can't wait to come up and see you, you know, as opposed to friends who I've known for years, who I still haven't heard from, who I haven't seen. So I guess they didn't like it very much. But yeah, when they can't wait to come up and tell you how much they liked it, he was just so wonderful about that. So I'm very glad that we came through for the church and did something nice for them, and of course they did something nice for me.
Well, that's wonderful. So let's hope that it does have an afterlife. So what happens with that next? Do you try to go out and get it out there in front of artistic directors, or is that a job of a producer to do, or what do you think the next?
Yeah, we're all trying to get somebody interested. Frankly, we did have a nibble, you know. I mean, somebody we'll see if that amounts to anything. But nevertheless, we have had one quasi offer so far. So we'll see what happens. But you know, nothing real yet. You know, I mean that we can really say, oh yeah, coming soon to blah blah blah. No, not quite yet, but still, there was at least a modicum of interest. So if we live long enough, we may see it again.
Well, great. We hope so. And of course, you'll let us know. Mm-hmm. So moving on, Michael got a chance to see Handle With Care at the West Side Theater. So Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I would say that this was heartwarming also. It was a good show to see for the holidays, although I wasn't necessarily expecting that. And interestingly enough, it's about an Israeli woman and her granddaughter who are doing a little tour of small towns in Virginia. And, you know, at first you're like, well, why are they, are they, you know, but it turns out that there's a very good reason for that. And I really enjoyed it, even though I think it had some plot holes that I thought I spotted, and it wasn't maybe the most polished piece I've ever seen. But Jason Odell Williams wrote it, and I think it shows a lot of talent and a lot of ability to write very well for characters and make them sound natural. So I look forward to more from him. Let's see. He is actually an Emmy Award nominated writer whose plays have been produced at the DR2, The Cell, The Kitchen, the Gulf Shore Playhouse, lots of other places. I look forward to more from him. I actually did. I had some problems with the direction also by Karen Carpenter, and this is, I have to say, I found this a little hilarious and kind of embarrassing. This is the first line of her bio. Most notorious for her smash hit Love, Loss, and What I Wore.
Isn't that interesting?
Notorious means widely and unfavorably known.
Yeah.
As in a notorious gambler. So I think maybe she should have looked that up before she put it in her bio.
Aha. There's no irony here. You think she really assumed that notorious, like, that's true. You know, so many times people say notoriety when they really mean fame. So you think that's what's going on here?
I think so. I don't see why she would be being ironic. I mean, it's not even like it's a show that is done like thousands and thousands of times everywhere. And so you might say most notorious is the director of Cats or something like, you know, but I mean, I could be wrong, but I think she just doesn't know what the word means. So.
Yeah.
And I love that piece. I love love loss and What I Wore. So I think that she did very good work on that piece. So I don't think she's notorious for it. I think she's well known and justly praised for it. But back to Handle with Care. It was also great to see Carol Lawrence on stage as the grandmother, doing what to my ears sounded like a very convincing Israeli accent. This is one of those plays where actually the woman who played her daughter, the actress name is Charlotte Cohn. She did a wonderful job, because it's one of those plays where when we see scenes of the grandmother and the granddaughter alone, they are speaking in English, accented English. But then what happens is the grandmother dies, and we actually see her only in flashbacks. So in the other scenes where Charlotte Cohn is interacting with the two men who play the other two characters, she is actually speaking in Hebrew. I really give her a lot of props. She did a wonderful job of that, and I'm not she's someone who I'm really not familiar with her work, but there again, I'm looking forward to more from her. And this is at the West Side Theater, and just a really lovely, imperfect but lovely play, that the kind of thing you like to see off Broadway, where there aren't that many of those types of plays anymore. Mm-hmm. For various reasons that we've discussed before. Mm-hmm. But I'm very glad I saw it, and great to see Carol Lawrence. I read recently, there again, it's the Marnie Nixon tie-in with the movie of West Side Story, but there is a famous photo on the original cast recording of West Side Story of Carol Lawrence and Larry Kurt, and it turns out it was taken on West 56th Street by Leo Friedman, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, iconic photo of them sort of like running and almost half dancing down the street. And it turns out that street, believe it or not, remains almost completely unchanged as far as the buildings, in front of which they were photographed. And I came across it not too long ago, and I know someone did a wonderful photo feature online of superimposing the original photo on a modern day photo taken from exactly the same angle. So that's worth looking up because it's really fascinating. But also I've read, although I haven't seen it, that Miss Lawrence recently went back with a photographer and was photographed on that exact spot. And that's 1957. So that's a really long time ago. That must have been quite an emotional experience for her to be there. And of course, Larry Kurt has been gone for several years now. So I just love when, you know, theater history, things like that happen, things that are resonant like that. And to see her in this play doing such a wonderful job in a non-singing role really, really was wonderful.
It happens to be the street where I live, but not the block where I live. So I pass it many, many times. And while a lot of people didn't know about where that photo was taken until that online feature that you're talking about, if you look carefully on your original cast album, you will see that a trash can does say, I think, 410 West 56. So there's no question that's where it was done.
That's how I found it.
Oh, yeah. OK.
Because if you see especially if you see a large version of that photo, it's quite clear.
Yeah.
That's right. I didn't know you were on that block. I thought you were on 54th, but that's interesting.
Now, Carol Lawrence, I have to say that a few years ago, we asked her to appear at the Theater World Awards because she is a Theater World Award winner for West Side Story. In case you don't know what the Theater World Awards are, they're given to people making their debuts. And Carol Lawrence made a splashing debut in West Side Story. So we asked her to come back and we asked her to sing. And I'm telling you, from the first second we dealt with her to the last second that we said goodbye, she was a 100% cooperative pleasure. She was so lovely through the entire experience. And believe me, this doesn't always happen. I'm reminded of when I was Drama Desk president, and I will never forget the look that Kelly McGillis gave me when she came up to present an award, which really the look on her face said, let me do this and get the hell out of here. You know, so I really appreciate it. Carol Lawrence did much more than Kelly McGillis did, and yet she was lovely about it. While Kelly McGillis did the absolute minimum and made you really know I'm doing you a favor, buddy. You know, so as a result, I will always love Carol Lawrence, and I'm looking forward to seeing her in this show.
Well, I can add to that. I saw the most recent edition of Forbidden Broadway, and Carol showed up apparently completely unannounced one night. And the cast was just thrilled, and she stayed afterwards and talked with everyone. She must have stayed for like an hour and a half.
Wonderful. That's
talking
great.
With every single person in the cast and in the audience who wanted to speak with her. It was fantastic.
Mm. Let me get back to Karen Carpenter for 1 second, because I was wondering maybe it was an oversight in the printed program. So I went to the online site for Handle With Care, theplay.com, and it says Most Notorious there too. So I'm thinking that maybe that she has planted her tongue firmly in her cheek, because I'd imagine a lot of people read these things before they're ending up, and she's used this Most Notorious in other bios as well.
I've not quite heard it with the word notorious. I hear the word notoriety used so often for something positive.
If I
had a nickel for every time that I heard that, I could buy a premium seat to the Book of Mormon. So, I have a feeling, you know, it'll be I wonder if we'll hear from her, you know, if she'll address this issue, if somebody tells her about it, that they were making quite a thing of it this morning. But nevertheless, you know, we are talking about the English language, and it's better to be precise. I mean, all of us make mistakes, Lord knows.
Interestingly enough,
let me ask you a different question. When you are listing the awards that you've been nominated or won or things like that, in what order do you do it? Do you do it from biggest award to smallest award, or do you do it from smallest award and build up to the biggest award?
I think most people do it from biggest to smallest.
And that's what my assumption is too. So it says her most notorious for her smash hit Love, Loss, and What I Wore by Delia and Nora Ephron, parentheses, Broadway World, Drama Desk Awards. So is the Broadway World Award larger than the drama desk?
Maybe in her mind, I don't know.
There's nothing wrong with doing it the other way either, you know.
Anyway, but
God, you believe what we're doing to this lady's bio? Good Lord! I mean,
well, I
I'm not quarreling. I'm just saying, who expected this to become such a big thing that we're talking about? So,
but to confuse the issue, I'm looking up Peter. I'm looking up notoriety on the online dictionary, and the first definition is the state, quality, or character of being notorious or widely known. And the second one, it says chiefly British, a notorious or celebrated person.
Well, there you are. Then I'm wrong. So
no, but I mean you're not wrong. It's just I hate words that have two different meanings.
Sure.
like the word moot. Which moot means, you know, it means debatable, but it also means it's a dead issue.
Right.
Those are two different things.
Oh, Michael, I'll attest to you that anybody with children knows that the word no means many different things, especially right before Christmas. So
that's great.
So let's get off of the Karen Carpenter. That's the other thing, is that she's got such a famous name.
Yes. Yes.
Sure.
So I wonder if that's also why she might also take a little poetic jab at her bio as well.
So, we can invite Miss Carpenter to write in and let us know if she was kidding.
Well, let's have her on. Let's have her on and let's talk to her and say hello. I mean, she's certainly an extraordinary talent.
Yes.
So I'm looking at Jason Odell Williams, who is the writer for Handle With Care. Mm-hmm. His author's note is very clever. He started it out with, "I'm not Israeli, I'm not even Jewish, but I've always been fascinated with faith and religion." Sort of like Josh in the play, "I grew up religion light." So it seems as though that there's a lot of humor in involved here.
Sure.
So let's move on to our good friend Ashley Brown, who had she was singing on the corner somewhere. Where was that, Michael?
Yeah, the corner of 57th Street and 7th Avenue.
Oh, yeah, that's that corner. I know that corner, yeah.
Carnegie Hall.
Yeah. So tell us about that.
Oh, it was a wonderful New York Pops concert with Ashley as the guest artist and the Essential Voices USA. And it was called Under the Mistletoe with Ashley Brown, which I'm sure many people would like to be in that position. she looked fantastic. She had three different gowns. And she sounded beautiful. She got to show off, I think, more of her voice and more of her vocal range than she had an opportunity to do in Mary Poppins or Beauty and the Beast. She's really got some high notes there, that lady, I have to tell you, and she sounded great. And it was, you know, mostly traditional songs. Let's see, she did "It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year," "Winter Wonderland," a song called "Where Are You Christmas" that I'm not familiar with, James Horner and Will Jennings. "The Secret of Christmas," which is Sammy Kahn and James Van Heusen. And I'm not even sure I knew that it was Kahn and Van Heusen. So that's something I learned by reading the program here. And, you know, this, "I'll Be Home for Christmas," wonderful things in various, sometimes with the chorus, sometimes solo, but always with that amazing, fabulous large orchestra. There's nothing like a concert in Carnegie Hall with a beautiful, huge wreath on stage and a large orchestra. People singing traditional songs to put me in the Christmas spirit. So that was really great. And the next day, I went to see children's program with the Pops, presented by the Weill Music Institute. Charlie Brown Christmas little stage concert version of that, only about 45 minutes long, which I thought was so smart of them. But again, it was the full Pops Orchestra and the Essential Voices. And then what they had was, I didn't like this decision so much. They had three very, very talented children reading the lines of the Peanuts characters. But then they had, they felt they wanted to have adults or young adults sort of miming the roles. I'm not sure why they decided to do that. I didn't think that was the best choice, but they did. The audience loved it anyway, and the biggest laugh of the the afternoon was that wonderful moment right from the TV special where Charlie Brown, you know, he gets this kind of fragile little tree that he thinks that that's the tree he wants for Christmas because he doesn't want an aluminum one. You know, he'd rather have a real live green tree, even if it's a little fragile. So he gets it and then he tries to decorate it and he puts a Christmas ball on it and the whole tree kind of bends over and he says, "I've killed it." That kind of big laugh from the kids, you know, because I it's such a wonderful moment in the special and it was well done. And John Tartaglia, our friend from Avenue Q and the Gazillion Bubbles show, he narrated it. And then he sang a song that was a lovely song and I know is not in the TV special of Charlie Brown Christmas. And because of this presentation didn't have a full program, I cannot tell you what that song is. So I'm going to have to do some research. I think maybe it was a separate Christmas song written by Vince Guaraldi, who wrote all that famous music for the TV special. So I'm going to have to find that out. But that was really intriguing and a very nice surprise.
Well, that's great. I will have to check that out. We remind people that Ashley was on with us just about a month ago, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes if you missed that so that you can go back and listen to that interview with Ashley before the concert. It was a wonderful interview.
And she spoke about how it was her Carnegie Hall debut and how her whole family was there. And she just seems so sincerely grateful and happy for to be in a position like that and to fulfill a dream like that. And in fact, she sang the one non-holiday song she sang was very interesting, the John Buchino song Grateful. And she sort of did that as a Thanksgiving sentiment, and it worked beautifully. All around just a fantastic concert. And I've said this before and I'll say it again, you really, if you are a Broadway fan, you should definitely get to know the New York Pops, because it's a like something like 80-piece orchestra. They tend to do a lot of Broadway stuff, and they've in recent years had many Broadway talents sing with them, such as Cheyenne Jackson and Megan Hilty and Ashley Brown and many, many others. Kelly O'Hara has sung with them several times. And the ticket prices, depending on where you sit, can be considerably less than Broadway. So you're getting this huge orchestra, top Broadway talent. You're in Carnegie Hall. And I just can't recommend it highly enough.
I ran into Ashley on the subway the other day, and I with her very lucky boyfriend, no question. And it was funny because we're mentioning all her success. I don't think it's much longer before she'll only be taking cabs, and we won't see her on the subway anymore. More to the point, I've known Ashley since she was in college because she's from Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, where I go twice a year and do a class. So she is a lovely person, and none of this has gone to her head in the worst sense of the word. She really is still wonderfully down to earth, and I'm delighted for her success. So may she reign forever.
Yes, I think, you know, it can be very difficult for people to kind of suddenly or very quickly make it and retain that that wonderful sincere grateful outlook and kind of remain real people. But she is definitely one of those people. Jonathan Groff is another one I always cite, who just I guess they must have had really wonderful upbringing with really 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 great parents.
Well, those seem like two very New York things to do, Michael, and I'm so glad you got a chance to see them. Two very different but outstanding performances, it sounded like. Yeah. So I guess that kind of wraps it up for us this week. Anything you guys want to mention for what's coming up?
I'm going to A Christmas Story today, catching up.
At the Garden?
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, great.
Despite the venue, you know, I mean, I am looking forward to that. So And then, of course, going away for the holidays. So we'll see what happens after I get back. But I love A Christmas Story. So this is something, even with the venue, I want to see how it works there, you know, if it can still trump its surroundings. And I won't be surprised if it does.
You know, Peter, I always say, like, the scariest night of the year is is Bat Night at Yankee Stadium. When they give out,
right.
give out bats, you know?
Oh, but, yeah. So I was there one night. I was petrified, yeah.
You don't do a Yankee Red Sox game on bat night, you know, all the fights in the stands. But what about, are they selling the pop guns at the at Christmas Story? I don't know if everybody's coming out of the Madison Square Garden carrying guns, you know? I'll let you know
next week.
Oh, you know what? I wanted to ask you guys, did you happen to see this article in the Telegraph over London about Andrew Lloyd Webber saying that he can't afford to do any more musicals?
Yeah.
No, I did not. What?
Let's take up a collection.
Yeah. I was like, how long is Phantom running? And he's had a movie. And I mean, Phantom has grossed more than any other entertainment thing in the history of the world. And not to mention Jesus Christ Superstar and Joseph and all the other stuff that, and he was interviewed and he's opened up this new musical called Stephen Ward on the West End, and it cost £2.5 million to stage it. And all I can think of is like, okay, £2.5 million, you can't get a small off-Broadway play going for that.
Sure.
Well, he doesn't have to produce all of his shows.
No.
That's another option, you know.
Yeah, I was watching this and I was like, you know, on Twitter they talk about big first world problems. Yeah. You know, it's so hard to walk from one end of my mansion to the other. It's so, I feel bad for me.
Well, he also has been kind of annoying lately and talking in the press about supposed film versions of Cats and
Sunset.
And didn't he also say Joseph?
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just like, really? I don't know.
Okay. Well, you know, but this Stephen Ward got mixed reviews over on the West End.
Oh, no. It got mostly negative reviews. They weren't mixed. They were mostly negative. This is a euphemism.
That was, you know, it's like when they say ball players got flu-like conditions.
Yes,
you know what that means, Michael? When they say, you know, oh, this baseball X can't play today because he's got flu-like conditions.
Oh, actually, I've never heard that. What is that?
Yeah, that means that he's hungover.
Oh.
So, you know, oh, yeah, no, he can't play today. He's got flu-like conditions, you know, in July. Who gets the flu in July? So, yeah, okay, so I had heard it was mixed, but it was mostly negative, so I guess we won't see it.
Well, I'm sure some people found something positive to say, but Peter is correct, if I understand correctly.
You know, Whistle Down the Wind didn't ever seem to make it, did it now?
So. You know, what was really fascinating is a few years ago, about 5 years ago, there was a touring production that went out, and I went to Philadelphia to see Whistle Down the Wind, which indeed had been a big incoming Broadway show about 5 years before that. It was supposed to come to the Martin Beck Theater and all that, and that never happened. So now there was a touring company going out, and the closest it was coming was Philadelphia, and I wanted to see the show. So I went down to Philadelphia, and it was so amazing to be in the Merriam Center, the former Schubert Theater, and with a house that was probably a quarter to a third filled. And I'm thinking, wow, there was a time when any Andrew Lloyd Webber show just automatically sold out. And it was so fascinating to see so many empty seats. And the audience that was there looked like they didn't want to be there, that they had bought tickets in advance, and what a mistake that had been, you know. And whoa, what a woeful situation, really.
All right. So, Michael, anything coming up for you?
Well, I just wanted to mention again, this Thursday, the day after Christmas, the 26th, My Fair Lady at the Walter Reed Theater, the film, is going to be screened at 3:45 p.m. As part of their George Cukor Festival. And on Sunday, the 29th, Born Yesterday. with Judy Holliday recreating her amazing performance of Billy Dawn that she created on Broadway in that wonderful piece. That's at 3:45 and at 8:30 on the 29th. And I believe that evening, though, you might not want to go to the evening screening of Born Yesterday, because that evening is the Kennedy Center Honors telecast. So you might want to tune that in.
Okay, well, that's great. So I guess let me wrap it up by saying you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, you can listen to us on Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. Or listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, also as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I know now I was wrong.